Well, this has been a side project for 1 or 2 years now. It's still in its beginnings. And I thought it would be nice after such a concentrated week last week to have a little diversion and to think about something a little different. Not sure this will really qualify as a complex fluid, but in a sense, people who have been caring about systems with Smith flexibility and so on, so things which have curvature, will recognize some of the ideas we will be exploiting. So let me start with a long text. Yeah, I'm afraid your eyes will be strained by the talk, but other transparencies will be better than this one. I still thought it was interesting to let the text as it stands in the translation from the Greek, because this is the first quotation I found about somebody who worried why are pebbles round. And as a matter of fact, although people have worrying about this over the years, I don't think there is a clear or insightful explanation of their shapes, and at least of a way of characterizing them. So as you can see, Aristotle, this probably was not written by Aristotle himself. This is from the Aristotelian school. I can read what's in there. Why are the stones on the seashore, which are called pebbles round, when they are originally made from long stones and shells? Surely it is because in movement what is farther from the middle moves more rapidly, for the middle is the center and the distance from this is the radius, and from an equal movement the greater radius describes a greater circle, but that which travels a greater distance in equal time describes a greater circle. Things traveling with a greater velocity over a greater distance strike harder, and things which strike harder are themselves struck harder.
Makes sense.
So that the parts farther from the middle must always get worn down. As this happens to them, they became round. This doesn't seem so easy to follow, but in the case of pebbles, owing to the movement of the sea and the fact that they are moving with the sea, they are perpetually in motion and are liable to friction as they roll. But this must occur most of all at their extremities. So the Aristotelian school has a little bit of minor works, which they call the mechanical problems. And this is the 15 of the mechanical problems. Other things are concerned with levers and that type of... So this is question 15 of mechanical problems in Aristotle, minor works. And this was translated by Mr. Head from the Harvard University. And I was talking about this problem to somebody in Portugal, as a matter of fact, and this person was just reading these works, and he told me, there is a reference to pebbles already in Aristotle. So,
and Aristotle is probably quoting somebody else who's older than
him. What the guy says is that this probably was not written by Aristotle himself, but by his school, which spans about 200 years of thought. About 2 or 3 BC.
You're going to show some data.
Sorry?
You're going to show some data.
I'm going to show some data.
I wouldn't argue that all pebbles are round. Lots of times you go to the seashore and there'll be a particular beach where they're all flat.
Okay, all right. And as a physicist or as a theoretician, I will be mostly concerned about flat pebbles, you know. 2D is easier than 3D. but let's go to the point. That's true, and that's the question, isn't it? So let me first go through the names of the people who were contributed to this. So this is the place where I work. Those who don't know Strasbourg might have a little picture of the university. The laboratory name is called Laboratoire Dynamique des Fluides Complexes, meaning, you know, complex fluids, dynamic of complex fluid laboratory. I work there. It's from the picture, quite nice. When I first started thinking about this problem, I didn't know anything about pebbles, and I discovered by chance that across the street, really there, on the other side of the street, there is a geology institute. And in that geology institute, there is a person who defended his PhD thesis perhaps 10 or 15 years ago on Alsatian pebbles.
Specifically Alsatian pebbles?
Well, pebbles in general, but Alsatian pebbles too. There are a number of chairs right behind the... Okay. So we have been collaborating on this project, and the people who really did most of the experimental work are a student, Hélène Bidot, and André Schroeder, which is a colleague of mine from the laboratory. Douglas Durian visited last year and helped us with the characterization of the pebbles, so he's pretty much into this project too. And Philippe Duranger is the guy from geology that we have been collaborating with. You can find more details on my website and the knowledge support from the chemistry department of the CNRS. We have been generally supporting us for a number of years now. So this colleague of mine, he's actually a person who's an expert in sedimentology. And when you find a number of pebbles in some sedimentary layer, what you'd like to tell is where those pebbles came from. What is the origin of those? So people in geology have tried to develop ways of characterizing the shapes of the rocks. And the typical method they use, this is one of the reasons for which I started working to think about this problem, is that there's a very simple method which just basically is assuming that the rock you take is an ellipsoid and taking three axes, the larger axis, the intermediated axis, and the shorter axis. So three numbers, the LIS numbers, as they say. And from those numbers, what you do is that you build a triangular diagram, a shape diagram. And I won't put any combination of the numbers in here, but you can imagine that from these three numbers, you can make three combinations that will make in this diagram something which is almost circular to be at one corner, something which is flat but symmetric in the other direction to be at the other corner, and the other thing to be more rod-like. And the idea is that by putting dots corresponding to the actual measurements from the field, you'd be able to somehow characterize the distribution of the shapes. People have been trying to do that for a while, and there are big discussions about what is the best the representation. And as a matter of fact, if you want to have your name in geology, you just need to make a new combination of LIS and write a paper. For the moment, there are about 16 different names and
what does LIS?
Long, intermediate, and short.
Oh, okay.
So there is a little bit of physical insight into the numbers sometimes people build. For instance, people argue that the shape of the rock should be determined by the ratio of, I don't know, volume over surface, and so you'll construct an index which for an ellipsoid would be the ratio of the volume that you'll get from these numbers on the surface and so on. That is too a sophisticated idea at this level. So that is some of the things we have been trying to explore, but nobody has used that idea before.
What about the aspect ratio?
So the aspect ratio is given, it would be, for instance, given by, it depends what you want to call the aspect ratio. It could be, for instance, the longest axis divided by the shorter axis. And if you do that, that could be, you could build a diagram where one of the sides is the aspect ratio. But that that really doesn't, for the moment, hasn't proved to give any really useful information. And people are still discussing about what are the best indexes to use. For instance, some mathematicians have tried to prove which are the indexes which give a most even distribution of shapes on this diagram and so on. So there is some discussion of this method. But what we don't like about the index is that, first of all, they are not in a clear way, or they are not naturally related to what is going on during the fabrication of the pebble, during the process that takes it from being very polygonal-like to more rounded. And as you'll see, this thing misses some of distinctions in shape. So what I'll now be trying to show is some intimate details of shapes. But I restrict myself to two-dimensional shapes. The reason for using 2D and convex shapes is, of course, a simplification from the theoretical point of view. But let me go through some, field justification of looking first at 2D shapes. And of course, that one of those is that those shapes do exist in nature. And my colleague from geology took us on a trip to the Mont Saint-Michel, which, if you know France, is right there. So this is the place. And Mont Saint-Michel has one of the largest tides in the world. It's the second tide after some place in Canada, in the this is at the Saint Lawrence River. I think it's near the outlet of Saint Lawrence River. Right, the Saint Lawrence River is on the Atlantic. Anyhow, okay. So this tide, what it does is that it brings lots of, as a matter of fact, animal-produced mud. So the shells produce suspensions, and this brings mud into the lands. And near these flats, which are called the tidal flats, at the seasonal high tides, they depose layers of mud, which tend to be layered, as you can see in here. And then, either close to streams or perhaps when it rains, these layers of mud are cut, and then you end up with I don't have a point. With my mouse, right? So these layers are cut, and you have these little pieces of mud that detach. If you look at them closer, they look like desiccation plates, and they have roughly polygonal shapes to start with. When they detach, then they move a little bit in the stream, or they are eroded more and more by the rain, whatever processes it erodes them. But the nice thing about this is that in about 20 or 30 meters, you see the forms evolving from the very polygonal shapes like this one. This is perhaps, 10 centimeters wide and 1 centimeter or a fraction of a centimeter thick. So it's like, right, so these are mud pebbles. You can take them, they look like pebbles, but if you do this, they'll break. If you go down the stream, they start to be more eroded. So you kind of see the erosion process, of course, not with one particular pebble, with the collection of them. And at the end, when you get to a sandbar, you might find the pebbles that look just like normal flat pebbles. So you can follow the production of the pebbles in this particular site. What we decided to do is to try to produce these shapes in a more controlled manner in the laboratory. So we set to do a very simple experiment. We took a white clay and produced these little shapes, which are perhaps 5 centimeters by 5 centimeters squares, with perhaps a half of centimeters thick. This was an idea by Philippe Boltan again, which has serious health problems now. But he proposed to just break the pebbles in this very simple apparatus. So this is a plate, and it's a kind of square. In the square, we put our pebble, and there is an electric motor that makes it turn. So as the plate turns, the pebble is going up the hill, and when it gets to about half the way or so, it falls down. And the movement is quite random, so it doesn't do always the same thing. There are variations about that. So when you use our pebbles, you rode our pebbles by this method, what you see is a shape evolution which looks like the seconds I'm going to show. So you see it starts to be eroded by the corners, the ones which are the mostly. I'm sorry? So the plate is at 45. Yeah. The pebble is just put on the plate. The plate is doing that, spinning like that.
And there's some water inside?
No, there is no water. So the pebble is just hitting the walls. Now there is also some powder that starts to accumulate because, right, but otherwise there is nothing in these experiments. And so you start to erode them by the corners and erode more and more, and this is, of course. So you see, it's not a deterministic process. The thing tends to be more round-shaped, a little bit less, but this is a typical sequence. Right, we had drawn an arrow here, because we were concerned about trying to follow the corners which we wrote first, so we wanted to know what was the orientation of the pebble. Right, it's drawn for the visualization. That's correct.
And it's drawn at the center. Right, the arrow is right at the center.
Right. One of the things we wanted to know is if the final shape, for instance, would be had the arrow in the center, or perhaps a little bit too. It's not quite at the center, is it?
But since the walls are flat, it can only get round in this case, because it cannot get smoother on the sides beginning. If the walls wouldn't be flat, maybe then it would get upshaped.
You mean we could perhaps get more concavity in the.
Yes,
for the moment, it looks pretty convex, isn't it? The clay is quite homogeneous. There are not lots of little clusters of sand or so that would make the thing break particularly. And as you see, the evolution around the corners looks to be identical at the different corners. So there is no apparent bias that we can tell. What we try to argue is that the curvature distribution of these 2D shapes is a good measure of what's going on. So at the beginning, this was just an intuition built from some simulations that I will show later, but it's quite natural to think about the curvature, because when you are cutting the pebbles, one of the things at least that you are doing is to locally change the curvature of the pebble. So let me think about rho of k, which would be some normalized fraction of the perimeter with curvature between k and k plus delta k. Perhaps I should make a picture first here in the in the blackboard. So if I have a shape, whatever shape it is, the curvature around the corners would be high here, small there, so it'd be a function, I don't know. Something like this, perhaps it has two maximums. This is quite regular, right? But so there is an average value of the curvature, and that's also why we got interested in the curvatures, because it's a conserved quantity in a sense. So this is L, the contour along here, and this is K of L. This here varies from zero to the perimeter.
The perimeter is changing during the evolution.
The perimeter is changing during the evolution, that's correct. I will see.
Is it integral over the perimeter of the curvature?
That's correct. So that's what is in here. The curvature being the derivative of the angle with respect to length, then the integral of that is just pi, so the average of the curvature is 2 pi over the perimeter. So the average curvature is already a measure. If you know the perimeter, you know the average curvature, and the curvature is distributed around that average. And so we thought, well, this looks like a nice variable to look
at. For a circle, it's just 2 pi, I mean, the perimeter
pi R. So for a circle, I will show that later, but for a circle, of course, the curvature is just that. It's a constant. This is the perimeter, and the value of that is, of course, 2 pi divided by the perimeter, which is 2 pi r, so it's 1 over r. But it's true in general that the 2 pi over perimeter is a measure of the average curvature of these shapes. We concentrate more on not on the distribution of the curvature itself, but on the cumulative function, which is the amount of curvature smaller than k. So this function goes to one for large k, because there is noise, of course, in the problem. It's somewhat more stable to work first with this integrated distribution than with distribution of curvatures themselves. And as an example, let's look at the number of shapes. So for a geologist, these shapes from that LIS point of view would be exactly the same, because apart from the circle in the middle, because they have exactly the same aspect ratios. The length over the size is the same, have the same value. This curvature distribution for a circle, of course, is a delta function. So the integrated distribution is a step function that goes from 0 to 1. That would be for the circle. For the other ones, you see that although they have more or less the same, they have exactly the same aspect ratio, the curvature distribution does capture the details or some of the differences between these different shapes. The ones, for instance, which have long, this doesn't quite work, that have long flattened regions will have larger zero curvature. And then the ones which have steeper or more stronger curvature will show up there as well.
Why does the distribution of curvatures,
the width?
Yeah, I mean, not the.
Well, they have different widths.
They can aspect of derivative of it. In other words, the distribution of curvatures as opposed to distance.
I think I could produce two different curves which have the same derivative of this distribution and still the same aspect ratio. You see, because the curvature distribution looks at the density of curvature along the contour, and the other quantity is an integrated quantity of the curve. So the actual shape is twice is an integral which is twice the integral of the curvature, right? We should keep that in mind. If we have the shape, the tangent is derivative of the shape with respect to arc length, and then the curvature is the second derivative. So we are working in a second derivative space. Okay. So so here is the sequence again of all these shapes that we produced, or that square that was eroded. We are going at the top from left to right here, and then down. You can notice that the perimeters, as Alexei was noting, they vary quite a lot along the way. But interestingly, if you build this quantity that I've talking about and normalized at each step by the only quantity, which is the perimeter, basically, so k average is 2 pi over perimeter, then it's quite interesting. At the beginning, the curvature has some rapid evolution. So this corresponds to the first three shapes, which are in here, the three blue curves. But after a while, it appears to stabilize around some curvature distribution. So all the shapes from here are in red, and all the red shapes, they more or less overlap. So it seems as if this process of building a curvature distribution gets to some stationary point where by further erosion, the size of the pebble is reduced, but the distribution of the curvature stays more or less the same, of course, with noise.
I'm wondering, with the apparent rig that you described there, if you don't have fundamentally different mechanism when it's square, where it might be more sliding process, perhaps, when it's round, where it might be a more rolling process, the impact would be different.
That's a good point. We think that's true. Now, the sliding itself, of course, does not erode the pebble from the shape point of view. Of course, it's the impact on the corners that takes bits out of the contour. But we, indeed, we also have round-shaped plates, and we are analyzing the data now. And clearly, you expect those to be much more round-shaped. And you probably know that people, when they want to do little stones, gemstones, which are very round-shaped, they buy these things that are called tumblers. You can buy them in gem stores. And if you put the stones inside, they follow this cylindrical movement. And by the after a while, they became quite rounded shaped, very, very, very well round. So indeed, if the cuts are more tangential, then you expect the shapes to be more rounded. And that's one of the things we are looking at now as we speak. We are analyzing that, and the curvature reduces, of course. But that's really the point of that I'm trying to make, is that the erosion process that you choose determines a distribution curvature. And so perhaps you can also, looking at the distribution curvature, find the signature of a type of erosion process. But I'll discuss that a little bit more.
How does the shape look like for an ellipsoid? You can extract the axis aspect ratio from comparing the shape for an ellipsoid.
So if I was trying to assign only a ratio here, I'd probably be close to one.
But if you put the curve for an ellipsoid in the diagram, it looks similar.
As compared, okay, I understand, I'm sorry. So the first thing we should note is that these shapes, although they look convex, they have a little bit of concavity. So the curvature distribution, as you see, does not start from zero, but starts from some negative value, which corresponds to some small negative curvature. So in my convention, negative curvature would mean concavity. And then you go there. The ellipsoid won't quite reproduce that, but I'll try to show curves that reproduce that shape.
Wouldn't that depend on how you coarse grain the perimeter? I mean, you have some lower cutoff in your resolution.
Okay, so now we are getting to the question, how did we get these curves, and how do you get a curvature distribution from an experimental as a matter of fact, extracting a curvature from a shape like this, from a pixelized shape. So the way we do it is that we take the pictures, then extract a contour from binarizing the material and so on. So what we have at the end is a pixel representation of the contour of those shapes, and is on that XY representation, say, that we work and we extract the curvature. This is an extremely difficult task. It's an extremely difficult task, and we couldn't find in the literature any good suggestion to do that. So we went through extensive pain of developing one or two methods, two different methods, for obtaining reproducible results that don't depend too much on what you do to the pixel representation. You should realize that the curvature is the second, as I said, is the second derivative of the shape. So if the shape has noise, the first derivative has much more noise, and the second derivative has much, much, much more noise. So I'd be glad to discuss about that by the end of the talk. How did we proceed? The photographs were always taken, of course, at the same height and so on. So we are looking at the projection of the image on the plane. I guess that slight different methods to extract the contour will give, I think, slightly different distributions. But I don't think that will change a lot, because that will only change on a local scale. And so it perhaps change that bit of the top of the curve over there. The right, the high curvature, the high curvature end.
There's more noise on the right part.
We do, because of that problem. Yes, if you think about two pixels, they are at 90 degrees. So the maximum curvature in the problem, of course, is 1 over r, where r is the size of the pixel. So that. For the moment, this scene here is just working on these pebbles, on these ones.
So each line corresponds to a single pebble.
Each line corresponds to a single pebble. Okay. So I'll show the data of average.
In effect, the sequence is the same one over time, right?
I'm sorry?
The same pebble looked at over time.
Yes, so this is the same pebble. I can tell you a bit more about the experimental conditions. So you make the pebble from white clay. It has about 22% of water content to start with. You let it dry 24 hours. It reduced to about 2-3% of water content. It's still a little bit fragile, such that it can be eroded in about 30 to 45 minutes. You put it in the machine. The machine goes around at about 1 hertz, one cycle per second. And the pictures are taking each 5 minutes. So the experiment in here with 9 pictures would correspond to 40 minutes. Just saying what I've stated before, that apparently we reach a stationary regime. And of course, we were concerned about one of the main questions, which is related to the influence of the initial shape on the and to the reproducibility of the this process, of course. So we did many of these shapes, but these are some representations. So we took squares, rectangles, and so on, old ones which are in here, and many more. For instance, the squares we did 5 or 10, and this one as well. So we have a number of shapes. And as you can see by the end, they look more or less the same. Of course, the actual size is different, but they are rounded, but not perfectly rounded. And we even went through the pain of making a circular, it doesn't look very circular, but it was circular, pebble to start with that we cut out of a glass. And by the end, of course, it's less circular because it has gone through the same process. So the curve you see here now, the one, the cumulative distribution, the black dots over there, are average over many realizations. So 4 are average over 4 squares, 5 rectangles, all of that. And for each of the shapes, the same thing reproduces over and over again. You see the curvature converging to a more or less identical final curvature after perhaps 4 or 5 steps. And more interestingly, the final curvature seems to be very similar from one initial shape to the other. So apparently we are losing the memory of the initial shape and getting into a process which only depends on the erosion process itself. When you have enough data, then we can take the numerical derivative of that to obtain the curvature distribution. So the red curve here is the derivative of that. And the continuous line is a fit, is a Gaussian fit to the curve. We did more sophisticated things like looking at non-Gaussian shapes and so on. But it looks, apart from the wings here, it looks Gaussian with some width, which is of course proportional to the average value itself. So it seems that everything is determined by the perimeter, as a matter of fact. Everything is determined by the average curvature itself.
These photos are to scale,
that's
and
correct.
To confirm, I guess,
this is the same time. Now, if I start with different squares, I should perhaps have shown that. You can start with the same square and end up with a different size for the final shape. So you do not always use it. This is a stochastic process, right? Of that, well, perhaps, I don't know, 20% or 30% in perimeter.
The final shape is nothing, right? It erodes away. You mean final shape after arbitrary?
Well, yeah, after this arbitrary tribe. If we keep going at some point, I guess, you don't erode it anymore because things became so tiny that its own weight, it's not enough to make it cut. But yeah, you can, in principle, you could. You didn't go farther than this. You still wanted. Right. We could try to analyze this in a deeper fashion by looking at the photographs and see what happens. It's true that this one typically would have a larger break than this one, which just starts by there.
Now you do have an ensemble average. Can you tell some other measure that tells you whether the width you're looking at is due to polydispersity in overall size versus anisotropy in a single pebble level? If I have polydispersed bunch of spheres, I'd also get a distribution of curvatures.
That's correct, but as normalized this way, they would give the same distribution. Because I normalize the curvature here by the average curvature, and I normalize the perimeter, the amount of perimeter above some curvature by the total perimeter. So this, as you see, go
to
1. I'm sorry?
That's
For each pebble.
Then you do your ensemble average.
That's correct. Well, this was the patience of the student that decided, I'm afraid. But we wanted to have enough shapes to be able to do some average and not spend all the day doing it. So the fact that we choose 7 or 8 steps, there is no rationale behind it. I think we could take it longer. We didn't explore that much. Right, that's the point, is that always it's quite reproducible, fact, is that as you eroded 3 or 4 times, perhaps the fourthest shape is already within the convergent curvature
but
distribution.
But if you start with different shapes, different angles, then you might take a longer time to converge or less time to converge.
Oh, okay, all right.
If you need a longer time to converge with a sharper one, of course you'll have a smaller final case with a sharper one.
Okay, so basically your question is there any dependence on actual initial size on this memory decay to the stationary state? Well, I don't know the answer to that. We did do some time evolution with the perimeter. So these are the perimeters normalized by the perimeters at the time we saw the distribution of curvatures converging. So time zero there means the shape that we decided was already within a final curvature distribution. So that's why you only have 4 points. These are not very, very significant for the moment. But already with those 4 points, it's clearly not linear. And we show that because that rings a bell to people in geology that have been eroding pebbles with these cylinders, with the tumblers. That's typically what they do. They take a bunch of rocks, put it into a tumble, and measure the mass as a function of miles, because each rotation corresponds to a distance. And what they want to transfer that is into miles. So typically in these papers, you have the decaying distance over miles. Of course, because if you are looking at pebbles in a river, you might want to know if how many miles does it need to travel downstream to erode. Of the thing also is that they sometimes erode just by staying at the same place, not traveling at all. But anyhow. Here we just used time, but that would be converted into distance if we wanted. And you see here there is a kind of time constant that is about 40 minutes.
In this case, in the process with the urban by gravity, it makes sense that the heavier the thing is, the higher the impact would be, the higher the stresses would be. And of course, as they get smaller, the less stresses on the rotation forces of the rotation.
That's correct. The other thing is that there is also friction with the plate. So although the mass increases, that means also that the friction against the plate increases also. So that the resistance remains the same, isn't it? For a given plane like this, if I have something which is heavier, the friction with the plate increases. Right. I definitively think that it makes a big difference whether it is mostly impact, the corners hitting the wall, or if it's something which is more tangential, like that. And we have a little model that addresses that question that I'll show just a little bit later. So. We don't pretend yet, so we should realize this is a starting project, basically, and we don't pretend yet to correlate these curvature distributions with anything in the field. But just as an example, since I talked about the mud pebbles from the Mont Saint Michel, we took basically three different sequences of these shapes from the beginning, right where they came out of these plates, somewhere downstream and close to the sandbar where they are really round shaped, and not surprisingly, the distributions also evolve. So for comparison, we have the pebbles from the laboratory here with the dots. But so this one has the widest distribution, and more or less we can say without being very precise that the distribution is getting narrow with age of the pebble as it gets more round. But as far as relating these results to what's going on in nature, we still have some way to go. And I'll explain some of the things we are doing now at the end of the talk. Go ahead.
So when the ones you showed, like this last one, to your eye, that looks relatively circular.
Yes.
When I look at the distribution, when you took the derivative of this, you got a distribution.
Right. I'm sorry. I should have explained that these red, green and blue lines there are average over many shapes that we took in the same condition. So it's not only that pebble now.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
But you also said that the pebbles were quite similar when you applied the distribution, single pebble distributions were remarkably similar. I guess what's bothering me now is that the distribution of curvature is much wider than we might have guessed if we tried to do it by eye. If you've got dk over k was
of the order of k average, right? Yeah, is a number, right?
But that means a variance. That means that the variance in the curvature is close to the radius.
That's correct.
Right. We would have all said the variance in the curvature in some coarse grained sense, but our eye picks up naturally is a small fraction of 1/radius.
Well, if you look at that particular one, for instance, that one is not a good example because it has that that tip over there. You see, and that tip is perhaps already three times the average curvature.
Right, so that's why I said coarse grain. I guess that's what it seems to make a huge difference over how coarse grain you're measuring the curvature is.
Oh, that's true.
If I do it fine grained enough, I can get.
Oh, if I coarse grain it over the size of the pebble, of course you won't see anything. But this is clearly coarse grain, that level of the pixel size, but it's not coarse grain, that level of the pebble. So you still see structure which is way below the size of the pebble. No. And one of the methods we use, as a matter of fact, rotates the pebble with the pixel, so we choose different pixel representations.
Okay. There's some natural cutoff that's smaller than what you typically pick by eye, which might be proportional to the size of this, but larger than the pixel.
Right, that's correct. We try to explain the evolution of, not really explain, but simulate the evolution of these pebbles by a very simple-minded model, which we call a cutting model. So basically, if you start with a polygonal shape, you cut a piece of an angle, you remove it, and you proceed many times along those lines, and a little animation that I showed at the beginning of my talk was really doing that, and that's where the physics comes in. So what do you need to do? In general, you have an angle and you want to cut that angle. So that angle has some measure, let's call it theta, and in order to cut it, you need to place a length and an orientation. And we call the angle inside beta theta. And of course, beta can be chosen between 0 and 1. If it's close to 0 and close to 1, this is more like tangential cutting. If it's close to a half, it's more like cutting perpendicular to the bisectrice of that angle. So these two extremes will correspond perhaps to different experimental situations, one in which you are removing pieces like that most of the time, and the other where you are just eroding gently along the tangent. So you see, just by choosing two numbers, we are able already to distinguish between the eroding processes. And of course, lambda will depend on the amount of energy you put into the cutting, because you need to open that fracture of size lambda. And if we choose the angle to cut, that's one thing. But then if you choose one angle and one length, so a value of beta and a value of lambda, you are in principle able to proceed to the next cutting, and you have done a cutting step. So here is an example of how things might look if I start with a square. I placed a cut here, then another one there, and so on. That is shown by the arrows. And you see that after a while, not many cuts, the pebble starts already to look at the to look quite round shape, as a matter of fact. I'm sorry? So I don't, this is just for an example, so I don't quite remember the conditions in here. I'll show later the conditions under which I try to reproduce the experimental results. But that's what you need to choose, is how to, you need to make three choices. The first is where to place your cut. You have many angles in your polygonal shape, so you need to decide, oh, this is the one I want to cut. You can do that randomly, or perhaps choose the one which is the largest. In here, I think always the largest angle was chosen. Then you need to choose beta with some distribution and lambda with some distribution. No. No. And I'll show that. Now, you don't have any concavities, the thing stays convex, so we are not capturing the small concavity that is in the distribution of the experiment, but it doesn't go to a circle. So we are here describing wearing of the shapes as a succession of values of beta and lambda. So this is more or less rephrasing what I was saying. You need to know your initial shape. Say all the sizes, the lengths of the side of the polygon and the angles. And when you know that, that's more or less equivalent to knowing the curvature at the beginning. And then you choose these values of beta and lambda to cut, and that's like making the curvature evolve. And here is an example. So if I take that square, depending a little bit how I represent the curvature, if I say that that square is a continuous line around it, then each of the corners is a delta function, and so it's the weight of that delta function that corresponds to the curvature that I'm plotting here. And so the square has four corners, each of them are pi over 2, and if I normalize, that gives that those four dots. If I make a cut, you should remember that in this representation, this is the evolution of a conserved quantity. So some of the corners get higher, some lower, such that the average stays still the same. So this is the basic evolution process. And if you proceed to make many cuts, and this is just another example, you have in this representation a curvature which is distributed around the average. And because we didn't do any particular thing for analysis, in here the curvature looks very peak. So what we are trying to see if this is true, if we can, from some curvature distribution, guess what was the stochastic process that led to that curvature distribution. It's like having, so I have rho, and rho is distributed with some average, and I don't want to talk about temperature, but that is in statistical physics what that would be, right? I'm opening a distribution, and I have some width of that distribution, and I want to know how that is related to the process that led to the width. So in order to compare with the experimental results, and I'm sorry, this didn't come out very, of for some reason was better before. here is an example. Our simulation is not very good yet, so we don't pretend to really reproduce the experimental results. In particular, if you see the sizes do not get very small as compared to the experiments. But here is an example of what can be done. So we used in 70 steps a probability distribution for beta, which is distributed in a Gaussian way around the value 0.5. So we are cutting most of the time perpendicular to the bisectrice of the angle which we have chosen, but with a fluctuation of about 0.15 around there. So the angles are being cut like that. And lambda is distributed with some exponential law, which makes the program run nicely. And so you see the shapes are being built. And if you use the same program that we used to erode the pebbles to analyze these numerically reproduced shapes, what you get is this. So now I'm working with the only convex shapes, so they are always positive. That's normal. And we see more or less the same thing. We have two or three shapes that are still out of the final distribution. But after a while, that probably corresponds in our simulation to about 25 steps, we get a distribution which is very close to the experimental distribution, because of course we tune the parameters for that to be so. So I'm not pretending anything fantastic about the simulation, the simulation, but this kind of mechanism does appear to show an opening a convergence to a kind of stationary process at the end. After a while,
your shapes are literally so.
Yes, they are.
So the curvature is either zero or infinite.
That's correct.
How again do you get finite curvatures or distributions?
So. What analysis we have done is the following. We reproduced the shapes by polygons. At the end, of course, the polygons are very small. And we made pixelized versions of those shapes. So we have XY pictures of it. And we analyze it in the same way we have analyzed the experimental data. So it's the same program. I'm not trying to make a mathematical analysis of the curvature on one end and an experimental one on the other. I took the shapes, made some shapes, and then use the same program to analyze those shapes.
Is it non-trivial to come up with rules which evolve to a fixed point, or was it the first step
The program is not very good in the sense that it gets very slow when the sides, each of the polygonal sides gets small. Within that constraint, sometimes if you choose just a random rule, you get stuck. You don't, your program doesn't go very, very far. But within reasonable limits, it's not very hard. But if I had chosen, for instance, a beta which would be distributed around 0 and 1, so corresponding to more tangential shapes, I would not have got such a wide distribution. Those tend to be more circle-like. They converge more to round shapes, if I can say so. Also, something of importance is the distribution of the lengths. If the distribution of lengths is very wide, if I had chosen them with a completely random distribution from, say, 0 to 1, then from time to time I can have a very large cut, and that large cut will avoid this shape to converge to an alpha. Straight away I have something which is very elongated, and then that might take some time to
erode
again.
The size gets smaller, lambda is not changing.
Lambda is changing, yes. It's changing exponentially. That's what I meant.
Well, it changes exponentially.
Right.
So lambda...
In this particular example.
Okay. So does lambda basically determine the typical size length of
Yes.
Okay, so you're not just cutting off the tip of the quarter, so you make the cut big enough so that the length of the side is comparable to the size of the...
That's correct. That's correct.
Since you did the experiment, did you observe an event where the shape became concave?
With the numerics are...
It can never be concave.
Not in here.
I also don't understand why a new experiment it can get concave. It was, but how it can?
It can, well, because, you know, some bits are chopped off of the shape. You know, they break out and they don't always... Right, that's how the shape evolves, is that they do that, and then they break out. And, of course, the bits that break out are not perfectly perfect straight. So they have bit chunks. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I should have said that the those ones are from... you might get some residual concavity. Oh, in the pictures here? No, in the pictures there should be no concavity at all. It's just a problem of the screen representation, right? No. No, the actual shape is not concave at all. By the way, I make it.
Did you allow cuts that cut off many corners?
Yes. Yes. In some sense, yes.
In a sense, isn't that really a reflection of the imperfection of the process itself? Because if you had a perfectly round bevel, you would cut a piece, and immediately you would depart from the perfect roundness, and that would mean a point away from the vertical there.
But if it's a shape which is really like that, with just a big chunk which has been taken off, then the distribution would perhaps be more like, I don't know, this one, the green one over there. Which is perhaps some intermediate state in here.
If it were really a perfect circle,
that it'd be a step function here.
Off, you would have the regular curvature plus 1 point.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
So, in a sense, the width there is really a reflection of the fact that you keep cutting chunks away from the circle.
Right, but not.
Isn't it fair to say that really it ends up being a circle, except it's not just a very good circle?
Well, but that's what we are trying to quantify, is to say if it was a circle, it would be a step function. This is departing from the step function, and that's a measure of how far from the circle it is, in a sense. Now, then the question is that we would like to address for the future is how different erosion processes depart from the circle, if you want. How this distribution is related to different cutting methods that we can choose.
The problem, though, is that in a real pebble, material is probably non-isotropic.
That's not.
And in this case, the circle motion disappears.
Well, let me answer that quickly. So, if you take a true three-dimensional pebble, many of those are isotropic. The material. They are isotropic. They are made out of small grains. Sometimes if you take granite, for instance, you have some very small grains which are indeed crystalline. But the material on scale, say, larger than a fraction of a millimeter, a fraction, 10 microns or so, then it's rather homogeneous. Some materials are layered, and some of those give rise to flat pebbles. And so they'd be an isotropic in direction, but that's why they are cut into layers. But then in the other direction, they can be isotropic as well. And as a matter of fact, if you look into the nature, the natural pebbles, you can almost immediately tell if there is some strong, for instance, cluster inside, because that is fragile, and that's actually during the next cut that the thing that gets off. So if you see a pebble with an indentation, probably that indentation corresponds to a piece of material which was not homogeneous. But so if you take homogeneous material like granite or limestone or something like that, they are quite isotropic, as a matter of fact.
But at the same time, though, and I'm
Oh, there are some conditions that make very spherical pebbles. From geology point of view, what they say, roughly to understand that, is the following, is that in conditions under which the pebbles roll a lot, like upstream in the mountains, they tend to be more round-shaped. And in conditions under which they stay longer time subjected to erosion process like wind or water rolling over or on the beaches, they tend to be more flat.
It's like symmetry breaking, since we choose to lay here and then we polish ourselves and we get flatter and flatter.
That's true. Okay. So if I can quickly conclude, so I think I have shown that at least to some extent the curvature distribution is a good characterization of these two 2D shapes. Whether or not we can translate that into three-dimensional pebbles, that's not clear. The number of invariants of the shape grows. The initial shape has some memory that eventually dies off. And this little model of angle cutting seems to reproduce rather well the evolution and the final curvature distribution for a range of parameters that is not very well defined yet. And the questions we are asking is there a classification to be made? For instance, can we attribute some original distribution of betas to a final distribution of curvature? Is that any correspondence that can be made, a kind of phase diagram that we could draw? And is there any universality hidden in this process? The things we are doing now, particularly our colleague geologists, we are implanting artificial shapes in natural environments. So we took squares to beaches and rivers, let them erode, and because at the end that's what they would like to know is, if you get the curvature distribution from those, can you tell this curvature distribution is characteristic of this type of environment, and that one is typical of that type of environment? So this is something for the...
Wouldn't this be a rather long PhD thesis?
Okay, see...
Do you mark? Do you put a center inside?
Now, since you brought out the question, let me tell something we did recently. So during the high tides in November, we took square bricks. You see what brick is, right? It can be quite strong. We took square bricks to a pebble beach in the north of France, not the same in the same place. It's called Etretat. And we put about 500 of these things in the beach. And went back at beginning of the spring, so beginning of March, end of the winter, and could find about 15 of these shapes. So many of them were lost, but we have some correspondents locally. They'll be looking for more and so on. So we hope to recover more. And it's quite interesting. Some of these shapes were not eroded at all, zero erosion. Some of them have been, in the space of 3 months, reduced to almost nothing. And we are sure these are the same thing. So we have a whole range of shapes to analyze. And it's quite surprising how strongly the job is done. And we think the erosion, as a matter of fact, is mostly produced when one of these things gets into the middle of the other pebbles that are there. And so it's the collective process that does that. The shapes that we found that were more or less far from the other pebbles and just being eroded by water and sand almost didn't move at all in 3 months. So those ones would take a very long PhD thesis, but these ones don't. And there is no PhD thesis starting yet.
So no pressure.
Bricks rolling or was polished like colliding?
It's quite amazing. So they The evolution looks a little bit like what I've shown for these clay pebbles. The ones which are not a lot eroded, they are only eroded on the corners. The ones which are a lot eroded, they lost both on lateral size, but also on thickness. Some of them lost half of their thickness. So some of these abrasion must be on, and so on. Our colleagues are very excited about that. They are making a publication in a geological journal concerned that, because it's very strange. Anyhow, so what we are hoping to do also is to compare in a more controlled environment in the lab other erosion process, and what you are suggesting, looking at a more spherical shape, is what you are doing now. And what we are seeing for the moment, of course, is that this curvature distribution is narrower. So we are quantifying that. And we are also looking a little bit into the theoretical aspects. We have been talking to people in applied maths, and apparently there is something that is used to reproduce in computer visualization all the like landscapes, which is called weathering. And for the moment, what I understand is that this weathering is produced artificially by taking a picture with different heights and taking the curvature and looking at the way the curvature diffuses in that landscape. I don't know more of that yet, but that's something I'll be looking into in the future. So I thank you for your attention.